Well, I have some sad news about Louise Mossy. No, she's in an Alzheimer's unit.
And,
somewhere, Louise Mossy. Oh, no, some of you don't know her, maybe. Some of you don't know her.
How did you learn it?
Well, I got a call from one of her friends. And I'm not sure whether it is Alzheimer's. She had had, as she told me, I called her a couple times, and she never returned the call. And this friend said, well, she forgot. Her memory's about 2 minutes long.
Yeah, she did it for me, too, about three times.
Not returned. Well, my friend said she just, her memory's gone. Mm-hmm. It's good for about 2 minutes. I don't know whether it is Alzheimer's or whether it is as she told me, a heart disturbance that affected her mind, whether there was a lack of oxygen that might have caused it. But I'm going to write her and send her a picture. Her friend said, send her a picture so she can put the two together. And if she responds, if anyone knows, you're going to write her.
Can you tell them where she is?
I don't know. It's in a nursing home in LaSalle somewhere.
In LaSalle?
Yeah, I guess.
Around that many?
Yeah, around there. And the woman said they just treated her horribly. The same story that I experienced. And she had like a little group of, a study group of women. Mm-hmm. And they all went in there and marched in and protested and got her some respect, and she said a nurse said one of these groups was a nurse and said she was medically very badly handled, that she should have been given oxygen when this thing happened. She wasn't. It's the same story that I had with my mom. You know, it's just appalling when you start dealing with this system again. So anyway, I don't know how long she'll be around, but yeah, I was going to check. She must be 90. Wouldn't you think?
My brother's 78. My guess is she may be kind of mid-80s.
Mid-80s.
Because she's a little older than he is.
I'll find out. The woman was on the road when I returned the call, and she's going to send me her address, so I can tell you exactly where she is.
Thank you.
And Gail Sheehy has written a book now on called Passages for Caregivers. Her husband died of, he was in a nursing home and had Alzheimer's, and she, from that, decided she was going to do a lot of research.
It's a hidden shame. It is a hidden shame. It is just atrocious.
A lot of it is about how to talk to people and what kind of verbiage to use and all that. So it sounds really. I've done a lot of research.
So often people take advantage of their bad temper because they know that people can't understand them. The Alzheimer's people. I mean, I've heard that at one of the places that's mostly Alzheimer's. And I couldn't believe it.
The caregivers, they are the...
The
nurse.
Because they're difficult, then the nurses are just all that more nasty, you mean?
I think she was so frustrated. Mm-hmm. And if he could have understood her, she wouldn't have talked that way. Mm-hmm. But since she couldn't, she was extremely unkind.
Can't speak for themselves.
Yeah, or, exactly.
That happens to the mentally ill, too. Well, nobody's going to believe them.
Right.
I mean, up to you, including sexual abuse, well, nobody will believe that schizophrenia.
That's what's sad, because they say the creativity and the emotional part of the brain still functions.
Yeah.
And and so they are really feeling everything, they just can't express it.
Uh-huh.
And so they're just so frustrated.
Uh-huh.
My mom,
it's like that very strongly.
Well, according to this woman, Louise is happy. She her memory spans like literally 60 seconds. You'll go to the room to go to the bathroom and she'll come back and say, you know, I haven't seen you for ages. And that kind of thing. But apparently not unhappy.
Well, having gone through it with my brother and sister, that you do, or for me anyway, it was a blessing to reach that stage where they didn't know. I mean, it was so much worse than they didn't know. We're struggling to mightily with it. And then when they finally got to a place where they were happy, I mean, once in a while there'd be a little, you know, resistance or pushing against when they didn't want to do something, but for the most part, they just, you know, they were much more docile and easier to get to be around and all that. And they seemed happy for the most part. Mm-hmm. Not happy. I wouldn't put happy.
Do they recognize you?
Well, yeah, during that stage, there was still some recognition, but then finally that leads to it.
That leads to it.
Yeah, that leads to it. They didn't know anymore.
I'm not sure whether this is Alzheimer's or whether it's complete brain damage from heart attack or apparently a heart through a clot and lodge in the brain, so it's kind of a stroke kind of thing.
It is a stroke.
Or just a lack of oxygen and if the heart gets weak. So anyway, she's always a good friend to me.
I was going to say, I used to say, Karen, she didn't know it was me, but she knew it was somebody that
she knew
cared for her and loved her, and she knew. I mean, she, you know, light up with a smile, and then eventually you know that.
But sometimes dementia and Alzheimer's.
So I don't know what the official diagnosis is, but I hadn't heard from her. We've talked about it, and I know Sandy knows it.
Well, I will call my brother. I haven't talked to him since this noon because he should be right on top of it. Was it a Karis that called you?
No, Marcia. I met Marcia. Marcia stayed at your place.
Yes.
I think they were just good friends.
Oh. She traveled with her.
Well, maybe I met her at your house then.
I think she might have owned a bed and breakfast, did she?
I think, yeah.
She owned a bed and breakfast somewhere.
Oh, really?
I think so. Yeah. I don't know whether she still has it. This was, 10 years ago, probably.
At least.
Yeah. Dates for next time. Karen, if you would be our liaison again, that's... We only get 6 meetings in next time. The way Labor Day... Memorial... I always get those mixed up.
It's Labor.
Labor Day... Thanksgiving and Christmas fall, it just kills 3 of our regular times. So I limited it to 6. I'll give you the dates if you want to mark your calendars. September 16th and 30th.
It's just 1 in November.
Pardon?
1 in November.
Yeah. 1 in
November.
2 in October 14th and 28th. November 11th. And we're skipping the 25th because that's Thanksgiving.
So am I.
December 10th. And then the next one would have been December 24th. I thought, that's stupid. It's going to come. And we could have started a week early, September 2nd. I thought, at that time, people want to enjoy another week or two of summer. So we'll just meet 6 times.
December 9th.
September 10th. September 16th and September 16th and 30th. Huh? Uh-oh.
What?
I think you're right.
December 9th.
I think I screwed it up. So am I right then? You want to check those, Sandy? September 16th and 30th, Thursdays?
That works, yeah.
Which one is wrong in December?
December should be December 9th.
Okay.
I always... 16
and 30. 14 and 28. 11. 11 and then 9.
And then 9. It would have been the 23rd. And right. I thought still, that's still too close.
In January, we'll meet first Thursday after.
Well, let's see. I hadn't gotten that far.
I was thinking just to mark our.
What's the first Thursday in.
I think he wants to have to go to the church. September? No, I'm sorry.
I can't figure that.
The first Thursday in January is the 6th.
So it'll be January 6th.
Okay. Right, that just helps.
Yeah.
Put that down, huh?
Yeah. And then I'll figure out the other dates from there. So I'm going to be away a couple of those times, too. So I'll give you the January through May later.
And when we're doing business, did I not get that, or...
The rest of the class would like to have this sheet if you still have it.
Oh.
It tells what page the images are.
I could print it out.
That would be very helpful.
Just email us if you want. Email it.
I'll email it to you. Even better. Okay. Write myself a note. If I remember where I put my note.
You're right. You're
so right.
What?
And then after you write the note, you have to remember to read the note.
Read the note.
If you can remember the place.
It's true. I put things in special places and I forget where the special places are.
Yeah, I do that all the time. One of our volunteers was a professor, and I mean, he was very simple. typical African writing professor, and he used to always say, I said, you got that, but I don't. He'd be like, well, I have everything somewhere. I just don't know when or what. He's like, okay, I'll give you that. We're talking about helping ourselves health-wise. These have antioxidants in them, so enjoy. Real fruit juices with acacia, pomegranate, cranberry, and blueberry. Smooth dark chocolate.
That's
so, it's just for your brain.
Oh, that's what these are?
I know.
What is
Trader Joe's?
Is it an acai berry?
Which? Yeah, acacia, that ain't acai, I don't know either. Pomegranate, cranberry, blueberry.
So there's fruit inside that.
Yeah. All right. Oh, okay.
Leave that. Someone says going to remember that. I forgot my list.
It'll
come back. Review. Today is
May 13th.
May 13th?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was the 12th.
Yes, that was yesterday.
Well,
yesterday was my cousin's
birthday. Okay, it's the
13th.
My watch is wrong.
You
make a note to change my watch. Might as well be putting the wrong
date.
Do we want the light back on here in the room?
Yeah.
You're
going to
be
talking.
No, trust me. I need the afternoon. The professor looks like he's on target.
Well, this is
sure. Gary, last time we were asking if there were biblical references to the descent into hell from the Apostles' Creed.
Right.
And so I found some and copied them. The first one, I did it super fast. I'm sorry if it's has any typos, but the first few are talking about the biblical view or the Jewish view of death at the time, which was that hell was something different than Sheol, where you went for, when you died, you were completely separated from God. But hell was different because hell meant there was never a chance of you getting reunited with God. But with Sheol, you just waited until the Messiah came. And so, death was a very bad thing because it was a time of intense separation, and Jews today who are conservative and observant would say that that's still the thing. So that's going. So then Ezekiel, as a prophet, went on to say, you know, when the Messiah comes, your graves will be opened up, mm-hmm. and you'll get to be reunited with God, and that's one of the ways that you'll know the Messiah. So that's why it was important for Christ to be sent. And then in the first letter of Peter, he says that he was put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which also he went and made a proclamation to the spirits in prison, who in former times did not obey. There's a lot of controversy in scholarly circles over what they meant by prison, and why Noah is in here at all, why it matters. But most people agree that there's some idea that in order to fulfill the messianic prophecies, he had to go open those graves. He had to reunite the souls that were waiting to be reunited with God with them. And that would be a very hellacious place because it's complete isolation and separation from everything that's holy, but it's never thought to be permanent.
It was the apocryphal Peter, I think, that explicitly said he goes down into hell. So that would make sense.
Yeah, this is the first letter of Peter. I didn't look at the Apocrypha because the question was, it's biblical and not everyone follows the Apocrypha.
Right. And this has absolutely nothing to do with anything. We were talking about another class. I wanted to ask you something you'll enjoy this, I think. What's the Montessori's view on competition?
A competition is only inward, and so we don't compete with each other because that's pretty useless and it doesn't create a peaceful environment or world.
That's what I was thinking. Good to hear that.
Yeah.
What were we talking about then? Zarathustra?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you just want to,
compete with yourself.
Compete with the, or with the work. Did you do it faster? Is it getting easier?
Mm-hmm.
But then encourage, so it's really neat because you'll see somebody be the first one done and all the other kids will go, good for you, you're the first one, hooray! You know, it's because their ego is not at all invested in somebody else's mm-hmm. success. It's only in their own success. And then what ultimately happens is, like, my daughter will tell you that the hardest subject for her is science. And then you say, what's your favorite? And she says, science. Mm-hmm. Because no one has acted on her in a way that says, if you can't compete in science, then you're not good enough to do science. So she'll say, oh, it takes me longer than everybody, but I love it. And that's a very typical Montessori. Mm-hmm. That's not unique to her. So.
That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yes. Thanks. Thank you. Okay. Here you. Remember, we're dealing with the death of the hero. And in that vacuum, the birth of a new God image. Putting in other words, a death of old values, a birth of new values. The importance of ambiguity in the birth of these new values. In other words, that it will be a confusing process filled with traps and error. The idea of being single in ourselves and communal in relation. We're going to see it much more today and the next time, how Jung begins to discuss the role of desire in growth. And he alludes to it on 245, how it desire for the outer world shouldn't be squashed because ultimately it leads to desiring knowledge of yourself. And then we stop. That's where we stop. Carol, you were going to check. Did you remember? You didn't check.
I did.
You did check.
I did.
We were just talking about there at on 245, one, two, the three last paragraphs. Jung is unclear about the relationship between the self and God. Eventually, he's going to say this: the self is the God image. He doesn't talk about God. Talks about the God image. But you raised the question of Atman and Brahman and Purusha.
Atman and Purusha, yeah.
Yeah.
And it says, I remembered, it's used both ways. Atman is used as the transpersonal aspect
mm-hmm.
and the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And Purusha is used that way too. And that is because when we look at those terms, we're actually looking at 5,000 years of Hindu philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And during that philosophy, these terms were developed and given specific meanings and transformed. And so, depending on what, if you stick strictly to the Upanishads,
mm-hmm.
then you tend to say it's Atman, and then also Atman,
mm.
because Atman cannot be divided, and it's an illusion that there is a personal
mm.
aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are if you lean towards the Samkhyana school of Indian philosophy, then you have Atman and Purusha in transpersonal aspects,
mm-hmm.
with there also being a personal Purusha,
mm-hmm.
which is the soul. And both Atman and Purusha are used interchangeably as meaning the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And both are used interchangeably, meaning the transpersonal aspect
mm-hmm.
just depends on what school of thought
okay.
you belong to.
Right.
And something that I thought, a little something I saw that I thought was related to our text was, this is from that aforementioned Indian school of philosophy, and there are two transpersonal aspects called prakriti, which is material, in nature. It's matter in its germinal state, and it's eternal and beyond perception. And then there's Purusha, which is the eternal soul, so to speak. And it says, and here's how I think it relates. It says, when Prakriti comes into contact with Purusha, it starts a process of evolution that leads through several stages to the creation of the existing material world. Prakriti is active, and Purusha is trapped in materiality and does nothing but observe and experience. Purusha, or the self, escapes from Prakriti by recognizing its total difference from and non-involvement in the material world.
Wow.
So there is sort of a Gnosticism, and also yeah. I think it relates to our text where he talks about the relationship between forethought
and thought.
And forethought and then desire,
yeah.
or what he uses a different word, doesn't he? Pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
So in our text, it seems that the Prakriti and Purusha are equivalent, in a sense, I'm not saying totally, to those concepts he's talking about.
I have one question. Is this Hinduism?
Yes.
Thank you. I think Jung went into this just because he's looking around for models of the relationship between the inner self and God. And he turned to Hinduism. And I think he received some guidance from it, but then we'll see he also differentiates himself quite markedly from what they're saying. But thanks on that.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to, well, that is why I brought this painting, because
okay.
I felt that those two ideas that he's talking about, the forethought and or Purusha and Prakriti, are reflected in this painting.
Hold off on that, and we'll
yeah,
talk,
I mean,
we'll
we may not even get to that.
We may not, yeah. But it's really, it's getting harder.
Well, it's getting harder. Can I go? I wasn't here last week.
Uh-huh.
The last paragraph on page 244, I must say the God could not come into being before the hero had been slain. The hero, as we understand him, has become an enemy of the God since the hero's perfection. The gods envy perfection of man because perfection has no need of the God. But since no one is perfect, we need the gods. The gods love perfection, but because it is the total way of life, the gods are not with him who wishes to be perfect, because he is an imitation of perfection. Is the soul in there any place? Is it after the hero's died?
Not yet.
Okay.
I think the hero to be, you know, these things get so complicated. I think it's helpful to water them down a little bit, simplify them a little bit, at least for an initial layer of understanding. I think you could almost substitute arrogance for the word hero.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is Jung is killing his arrogance. And as long as he's arrogant, that means he knows everything. And another understanding can't come in. So he has to kill the hero for the God to be born in himself. Again, that's a loaded statement, which we will be circling around. Let's say for the moment, again, just overly simplify it, just for the sake of discussion, that's tantamount to saying your arrogance has to be destroyed for a new set of values to take hold.
Because arrogance are complete in themselves.
Yeah, they know everything. Right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think that's what's going on. Now, I oversimplified it. I said the values that come in. I really should have said, but yet at this point in Jung's psychology, he doesn't have these ideas, is that the self comes in. He's just figuring out what there is if there isn't human arrogance. Later he'll say the self. He kind of says it here, but it's all muddled. I think that's one of the things that's difficult, because he hasn't got his idea straight yet. But I think it's fascinating to see how they emerge.
And that arrogance, then, is about imitation, keeping the status quo, the way of life has always been.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, is he kind of intimating that no true creativity then can come out of that myth?
Yeah.
But imitation is considered arrogance?
Yeah, that's something I would disagree with.
Yeah,
but let's stay with this train of thought for the second. I think... fads. Think of fads. Somebody wears a certain kind of t-shirt, everybody wears a t-shirt. Somebody drives a certain kind of car, everybody drives that car. And it's not just that they drive that car. That is their way of saying, I'm special. I'm different. I'm better. I think that's what he's aiming at. An imitation that tries to dominate by aping a style.
It's to bolster the ego.
It's to bolster the ego, yeah. I have an alligator on my shirt, and you don't have an alligator on your shirt, because you don't know it's cool to have an alligator on your shirt. I think that's what he's talking about. But I don't think that's totally... I don't feel imitation is always that negative.
Just your personal flattering.
Well, flattery, but you see, that's exactly it. Yeah.
But it also brings not that kind, but other imitations help us establish a society.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
They mm-hmm. bring a foundation yeah. to yeah. culture.
Yeah. Yeah. And you got to remember, when you read this, he is just poking in the dark. So for everything you read, stop and think, now, does that square with other things he said? Often it doesn't. Or it's a first expression of things you will hear later in a much more nuanced way. Now, what has he said about imitation in general? I don't know. But I can't imagine it would have always been negative. I mean, children need to imitate. That's, for example, that's the way they learn.
I mean, you know, you talk about second half of life, if imitation without reflection, it means you're just unconsciously defending or bolstering the patriarchal values. So.
Right. The danger is it simply supports the wrong value system. And he is so much at that axis of the death of the Victorian era and the birth of what we're still trying to understand, that I think he could take swipes at the imitation.
Well, it's pretense, too.
And pretense.
It's pretense. It is pretense because you're just copying mm-hmm. without...
Just copying, just spitting forward, spitting forth the old platitudes. I was at a cocktail party once and I was feeling... kind of rambunctious, and I said, well, I'm writing a book. Oh, what are you writing? And I said, well, actually, I've discovered the meaning of life. And my book is a description of the meaning of life. Oh, how lovely! Not even, what is it? But, oh, how lovely! And then chit-chat about the stock market or something, you know.
That's what's so good about cocktail
parties. Well, now we start important stuff. I think we've had some important stuff up to now. Spirit of the times and the spirit of the depths. I'm just trying to, again, we got so much stuff. I just tried to go back and just keep a couple of main ideas in mind. Spirit of the times, spirit of the depths. I think that's very crucial. The cave, the dead hero, and the murder of the hero, also very important stuff. This now might be the most important so far. So some of it, I have to warn you, we're going to go through sentence by sentence. Some of it we can go a little faster on. But it's terribly important, I think. So On the night when I considered page 245. On the night when I considered the essence of God, I became aware of an image. I lay in a dark depth. That's the same dark depth where the hero had been slain. See, so he's that slaying of the hero made room for this. An old man stood before me. He looked like one of the old prophets. A black serpent lay at his feet. Some distance away, I saw a house with columns. A beautiful maiden steps out of the door. She walks uncertainly, and I see she is blind. We've got an old man, a prophet, and a blind young woman, and a snake. And for several pages now, we're going to be talking with and about them. The old man waves to me, and I follow him to the house at the foot of the sheer wall of rock. The serpent creeps behind us. Darkness reigns inside the house. We are in a high hall with glittering walls. A bright stone, the color of water, lies in the background. As I look into its reflection, the images of Eve, the tree, and the serpent appear to me. After this, I catch sight of Odysseus and his journey on the high seas. Suddenly, a door opens on the right onto a garden full of bright sunshine. We step outside, and the old man says to me, "Do you know where you are?" That's just the beginning of that's the historiated initial. I don't know if anything you want to get out of that. I don't think it says all that much. But that's the...
Is that a...
Mysterium is at the top.
Oh, okay.
And B, the Gegnum, is encounter. So Mysterium is Latin, and the Gegnum is German. As far as I know, it's Latin. It might be German. I don't know. Anyway, it's Mysterium encounter.
Does anyone have an impression of that the bright stone, the color of water? Do you perceive that he says that's part of the wall, or?
Let me see.
Lies in the background, I guess.
I think it's a separate
thing.
Separate thing. So I would take that this is beginning self-symbolism.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the way to the self is going to be through this prophet, the blind woman, and Odysseus. So he's not in a position to describe what the self is. He's still on the road, trying to understand what the road is to the self. And it's a hell of a road. He says, so now we get an active imagination. I am a stranger here and everything seems strange to me. Anxious as in a dream. Who are you? I am Elijah and this is my daughter Salome. So, let's linger. Who's Elijah? Sibling. He's an Old Testament prophet. He challenged the prophets of Baal. The Hebrew people were falling away from Yahweh and worshiping Baal, a Canaanite deity, in lieu of their own God. To make matters worse, the king, Israel's king, Ahab, had married a Phoenician princess, Jezebel. So he's marrying a Canaanite. And Baal, of course, was her divinity. So Ahab had a temple to Baal built for Jezebel in the capital. And Elijah saw all this with fear and trembling, the falling away from Yahweh into the hands of Baal. And at this time there was a drought in the country. And Elijah challenged the priests of Baal to a contest to see whose God was Lord. And the contest was who could make it rain. The prophets of Baal failed. Elijah succeeded. And Elijah then tore down the altar to Baal and killed the prophets of Baal. And Jezebel was none too happy. And she put a price on his head. And he fled to Mount Sinai, and in despair he prayed to die. And you may remember this from Sunday school, that first a tumultuous storm arose, an earthquake, a wildfire, but it was in the still, small voice that Yahweh spoke to him and told him and gave him the courage to create a political revolution and reestablish Yahweh's power. So that's what Jung's talking to. In a way, you see how it fits in with what we've already been doing. This transformation of values, that's what Elijah was involved in. He went through suicidal despair. That's what Jung was either going through or nearly going through. And the question was rain. What values will allow life to become fertile again?
So they weren't already worshiping Yahweh. Yahweh was the new
some God. Were and some weren't.
But not, they hadn't quite made it to full worship of Yahweh.
Oh, they had made it to full worship of Yahweh, but they were falling back into the comforts of Baal worship.
So Yahweh was the new God image.
You could say Yahweh was the new God image that they had latched on to and then fallen away from, mm-hmm. and Elijah is trying to get him back to Yahweh. Now, the history of the Hebrews is this constant struggle to maintain allegiance to Yahweh against the Canaanites, the Babylonians, all the religions of luxury.
The interesting thing is that Yahweh was just a minor god. He's just a storm god. And they're trying to create a nation. And so to do that, they have to have a single god. So
yeah.
What fascinates me is, in this particular image, is that the powers of Baal collapse into Yahweh. So every time a god is defeated, Yahweh takes on those powers. So over centuries, he builds into this final monotheistic image. And it's fascinating because later it's like we go back and unpack those images out of Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
We have to unpack and move back into this policy of six. So it's like they all come together, and now he's at this point is going to begin to unpack them.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, for us it's a little distasteful, I think, this whole Yahweh business. But don't think in terms of, oh, it's Yahweh versus Baal. Think in terms of a shift in values, a shift in allegiances. Just as there was a shift from Baal to Yahweh, Jung is working on his own shift, and they have nothing to do with the shift from Baal to Yahweh. It's just a shift. But I think what's important is the price that Elijah pays is analogous to the price Jung will be paying.
Could it be too on an inner level that that worship of Baal then is releasing energy that can go back into forming the new values system? Because if you're with an exterior god like that, what I'm thinking of is, you know, if you have a value that's pulling you outside of yourself, and then you are cut off from that value now. So the energy that you're putting towards that in your life can go back into the unconscious, right, and revitalize. No.
Well, which god are you talking about?
Well, you said that Baal was a god of luck. These were gods of luxury.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And that's this time period, too, for Jung, is that luxurious life. And so cutting off from that then releases that energy that was going.
I see. Cutting off from Baal releases the energy.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what
Yes,
saying.
Exactly. And you know, vice versa, the temptation to Baal is siphoning energy away from that Yahweh worship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, I'm not sure, but I'm not totally sure. I think the Canaanites practice child worship. Child sacrifice.
Infanticide.
I think that's one of the great hatreds of the Hebrews against the Canaanites. And very luxurious, I mean, by their standards anyway.
There's a hymn that the chorus says, I'm hiding like Elijah in a rift of stone, and sometimes I feel just like him that I can't go on. Then a voice from heaven whispers in the rock, abide. And this is where I think it's important. I am hiding like Elijah from the storm inside. Mm-hmm. And so
that's more contemporary.
What is that from?
It's from this group called the Bishops that sings a cappella gospel.
Oh.
You don't really ask about my musical taste, but it's a really good album, and I like the songs, but I never know, you know, they're pretty evangelical, so they're probably talking, you know, I'm just hiding in the rock, but for me it's like you're hiding from on the inside, and it'll all be okay, so. But it seems like it fits with what you're going through here.
And sure enough, the storm shows up in the next image, Salome. So Elijah, now I'm trying to sum up a little bit, would be the part of Jung involved in the transformation of values. From Freudian to Jungian psychology, from atheism to an answer to atheism, from power to eros, pick any label you wish. But, and here's what I think is so interesting, he can't do it alone. Elijah needs Salome. Salome is a whore. Look at the contrasts. Spiritual values, sensual decadence. Who was Salome? They give a pretty good summary of her in the footnote, 158. Salome was the daughter of King Herodias, and the stepdaughter of King Herod. Remember King Herod from the bad guy in the birth of Christ story? In Matthew 14 and Mark 6, John the Baptist had told King Herod that it was unlawful for him to be married to his brother's wife, and Herod put him in prison. Salome, whose name is not mentioned, but simply called the daughter of Herodias, danced before Herod on his birthday, and he promised to give her anything she wished for if she requested that of John the Baptist. Now, we're going to see phrases like, I forget what Jung says exactly, despicable or something like that for Salome.
Bloodthirsty,
despicable. She is her new father is the brother of her old father. both are her uncles. So you see what a seedy little mess she comes out of. And she's responsible for murder of John the Baptist, who is not that far off, symbolically, from Elijah.
But she does it because her mother asks her to. She doesn't really want his head. Her mother says, he'll give you what you want, ask for the head of John the Baptist. And she said, are you sure? So I'm sure she'd rather have a really nice dress. I would have. And her mom said, yeah, that's what I really want. So, sure, okay.
Well, that makes it even worse. Because she's suggestible to the feminine shadow, you might say. But so you get the tremendous irony here that John the Baptist is the transformer. Elijah is the transformer, but he needs the help of Salome, who is quite a little wench, who kills, metaphorically speaking, and a figure that has the same psychological function as Elijah, who she's supposed to help. And both are true. This is what Jung is struggling with. Later, we'll see she's also, Jung links her to Helen of Tyre, who was a prostitute that Simon Magus, we'll talk all about this in a second, rescues out of a brothel. So you've got this image of spiritual revolution and the seediest, most bloodthirsty feminine, both necessary for the transformation. That's what he has walked smack dab into. And that's why I think it's so interesting, because we'll see how he deals with this and comes out in one piece. So Jung says, the daughter of Herod, the bloodthirsty woman. Elijah says, why do you judge so? You see that she is blind. She is my daughter, the daughter of the prophet. Now, again, the problem here is that both of these people are right. Both Jung is right to be suspicious, and Elijah is right to tell him not to judge. So these are the opposites that Jung has to carry. And she's blind. Which I take to mean that Jung's eros was totally unconscious. He didn't see the consequences of his eros. But what he'll be doing now in this act of imagination is trying to get the best of both figures on his side. You might say these two figures are the prima materia. The reason would dismiss this whole thing.
What was Jung's attitude toward women in general? Did he find them frightening, or some people to be subdued or controlled? Or
I think he was utterly fascinated. And at this time, I checked, and I can't read my notes. So not only do I forget where I put things, I can't read them when I find them. I think this, in the background of all of this, is his struggle with Tony Wolf. He had an affair.
Oh, okay.
For, I don't know how long time. Well, that's what I wrote down, can't read. I believe he was already involved with her at this point. Is that right?
Yeah. Down the page.
Oh, did it say that?
Well, no, it just says, why should I torment myself with a fellow mate? Do I not have enough of my own life?
Oh, yeah. I think that says a lot, yeah. No, I think he really loved women. And part of the problem, which we've got to go back into, is the times. That the Victorian morality was just breaking down. And so this whole thing of freer sexuality was brand new. And I think he and his association with Freud and sort of the cutting intellectual edge of Europe said, hey, I'm going to walk into this field. It's sort of like my generation in pot, say, you know. It's like, wow. And now you think, ugh. So what? I think he was a little bit under the spirit of the times, which is the wrong thing to do is to repress your sexuality. We know now you can be sexually active and be a complete jerk. But they, you know, even in my generation, Norman O'Brien and so on, these guys wrote about political freedom begins with sexual freedom. Well, we know it's not true. Or it's partly true. But, you know, there are plenty of narcissists who are sexually active and they're complete idiots. So this was going on, I think, historically, and Jung just said, to hell with the rules. Now, you know, you probably don't know this, Kenny, some of the others do, but he was honest about it. That's the distinguishing feature. His wife knew. He and Emma were, Tony Wolfe and Emma Jung were friends.
Well, this is going on?
Yep. And I know that because the guy who trained me would have relationship sessions with Tony and Emma together. They came and talked about the relationship. This, of course, draws fire sometimes. I don't discuss it in public. But I think both of them knew that they were all being assaulted with this process of reestablishing life's meaning. Meaning.
But Emma and Tony were not involved with each other other than...
Friends. They were friends.
But they weren't sexually involved.
No, not as far as I know. Yeah. I say that because, you know, it's complicated enough. Yeah. I have enough problems my own to deal with. I don't know if Emma ever had an affair. I have no idea. No, I've never had anyone talk about it.
I just have a thing with that word affair. I would hardly call it an affair.
It's not an affair.
It was a long, lifelong relationship, and it wasn't as, you know. I know you didn't mean that, but I mean,
yeah.
people put that. And yeah. I just think that word just means.
I really think he had two wives. He really had two wives. And that's part of his torment. That Salome demanded that he live out his sexuality. And he knew that it was wrong to do so. He knew it was wrong not to do so. Because without Salome, you see, Elijah is nothing. And a lot of what Jungian psychology is, and I think what Jung worked out at this time, is understanding the relationship between difficult passions and meaning. And that's going to be the thread for the rest of today and probably the rest of next meeting. So out of Jung facing this personal difficulty, reflected in these images, he's going to come up with a solution to his problem, and that is at the same time the foundation of Jungian psychology. And you can see he is moving from Freud's position on the importance of the instinct. He never, ever gives that up. But the instinct as a vehicle for knowledge, not the instinct as merely a biological need. Where everyone else has gone off, even today, I don't know of any other psychology that puts the instinct, besides Freud and Jung, that put the instinct central. And Jung never gave that up. Freudians are long gone from that idea.
You put the ego?
The ego, relationship, it's almost become social psychology.
I think that it's really interesting that he says, my wisdom and my daughter are one.
Yes.
She's blind wisdom. Is that she's
yes,
blind because Jung cannot get in touch with the feminine wisdom?
No, just the opposite. Let's look at that sentence, because what we're kind of doing now is summing up everything we're going to be doing. Why not? See, what is implied here is that you can't get to wisdom without lust. Without instinct. You could say, crudely, Salome is lust. And lust and wisdom are two sides of the same coin. Or, if you don't like that word, sexual desire. I think he would expand that later to other sorts of desire. That desire and meaning are not separate. If you hold yourself aloof from what you want, you will never find wisdom. See, that is exactly the opposite of the Christian, Buddhist, Islam position. Jung starts with desire and he never leaves it. But he sees it as a piece of a parcel, the other half of which is understanding. The question is, how in the world do you do it so you get both? And not end up in a disaster, three divorces or whatever, because eros is blind. Desire is blind. Desire just wants satisfaction. You know, how many women do you know who have married three alcoholics? You know, or two, three wife beaters? Eros doesn't get it. It just longs for a connection. Unconscious eros just longs for a connection, and it keeps repeating again and again and again. You may understand it's your father complex or it's a dysfunctional relationship. You meet that guy, and boom, out comes the eros. The mind checks out.
I had one person describe it to me as, it's just being compassionate. I'm just compassionate. And I just, you know, fell for number four because number three wasn't as interested or something.
And I bet you number four ends the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the blind Salome. So you need, let's say, desire. And you can define that as broadly as you wish. At the moment, for Jung, it's sexual. You need desire to get wisdom. But on the other hand, desire left to its own is horrendously destructive. He could see the destructiveness in the fact that he loved two women and that it was hurting both of them. But without that, Elijah wouldn't have a chance. So I think what's so remarkable about Jung, he looks at instinct and wisdom in the face and he realizes they're the same thing.
He really understands ambiguity.
It's that the heart of growth is ambiguity. Remember earlier he just said, allow room for uncertainty and failure?
Well, he's bringing the wisdom back to the body.
Another way to put that is that the body is the source of wisdom. The trick is, how do you get it out, and how do you live the instinct without destroying yourself? And I think the way most people solve this problem is they don't go with their instincts. How many married people do you know who are just bored to death? I may have told you I banged up my foot and I was seeing this physical therapist who worked with a lot of these race car drivers types, you know. I call them, I don't want to offend any of my moneyed rednecks. You know, if you look at them, they got the cars, they got the hot women, they got the big houses, they got the fast life. She said, none of these guys sleep with their wives. They all come to me because they want somebody to touch them. So, I mean, if you really look around, the way we solve this problem is to not really deal with the passion. And I've had so many people say, well, you know, I married him because I thought he'd be a good caretaker, or, you know, and then 20 years down the road, they're bored to death. And you're going to say, how do you keep them both together at the beginning so that you pay a price, but you have a life of both understanding and desire?
Where does your responsibility to other people or to society come in? Because from his point of view, I get it, and I don't disagree, but there are two people that he cares very much about who are heavily impacted by his decision to the point that it could prevent or inhibit their own growth and dealing, because their desire for him is not being fully satisfied because he's separating his desire. So, and where does his responsibility to them come in, or anyone's responsibility come in during this process of growth when there's collateral damage?
Well, I think thanks to what he's done, the journey can be a lot safer today.
Okay.
He's brought the tools. However, it's not fail-safe. That's for sure. I don't want to be Pollyannish about it. But I think he paid the price by going the long route and then finding out how you can work with this. And that's what this book is going to be about to a large extent. How do you work with this without causing catastrophe? Let's have a stretch.